From Nashville and Charlotte, this is the Shrink Tank Podcast. Each week, our panel of shrinks takes a look at pop culture through the lens of psychology. And today, we take a look at the resurgence of sci-fi and horror films and tell what we're personally enjoying this week. I'm your anchor in the storm, Dave Verhagen, here in Nash, Vegas. I'm a psychologist, an author, a Comic-Con panelist, and a bad magician. And in beautiful Charlotte, the Queen City of the South, sits our panel, Frank Gaskell. He tells people he's a psychologist, an author, the founder of AspieCon. He's also a certified dog lotioner, which we found out about. He's also the least emotionally stable person on the panel and perhaps on the planet. And most of the time, he's usually very happy or very upset about something. So, Frank, how about today?
I'm very happy about something.
Tell us.
Well, I went to go see my mother-in-law and my mom over the holidays. And my daughter was in the back seat with her, you know, iPad and stuff. And when we got home, she said, "Daddy, guess what season I am on The Walking Dead?" I said, "You're watching The Walking Dead? What?" She just turned 13, by the way. And I said, I don't know. Second season. She said, "Third season, episode 8. So she binged 3 seasons and 8 episodes of The Walking Dead. But the thing I'm excited about is each night we watch an episode together. And it's great. She loves it. And we get to talk about it. And it's like, I've got that kid. And she wants to watch Alien. And she wants to see all these movies. And I was completely grossed out by a scene and looked away. And she looked at me and said, "Daddy, really?"
She's comforting you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I see some role reversal going on.
I love it.
Desensitized a little. Just a little.
Well, you just heard Emma Kate Wright. She's a doctoral intern in psychology. We get to call her not quite Dr. Wright. And she loves things like Harry Potter and Game of Thrones and The Bachelor. And last episode, we made a little fun of your bad taste in pop culture. Mm-hmm. Anything else that's good taste in pop culture, like Harry Potter, Game of Thrones?
I mean, Harry Potter and Game of Thrones are great taste.
We keep just repeating those two over and over.
Yeah, let's just keep saying like, them keep over saying, and over.
Well, and
every
I love
episode,
I love The Walking Dead as well. So I have not seen the most recent season, and I don't know the big character that dies because I've been avoiding the internet like the plague in that area.
And
so
that's, you haven't seen this season. That's why you still consider The Walking Dead quality pop culture.
Maybe that's why.
Yeah. All right. When Jonathan Hederle is a licensed professional counselor, a substance abuse treatment expert, and he's our certified Asian, and he's written published book chapters on Game of Thrones, Star Wars, and Walking Dead. He's been a panelist at Heroes Con as well, and each week he scours all the potentially fake news websites for stories of psychology in the news that he serves up to you hot and fresh in our first segment that we call Being Human.
So recent research suggests that you will actually feel less empathy for someone of the same sex who has an attractive partner, at least according to a study published in the Cognitive Science section of the journal Frontiers in Psychology. Now, there is often competition between those of the same sex for partners, and this competition can affect people's attitudes.
Well, I thought this is really interesting research, and it makes sense. It's got a lot to do with reproducing and
what's
having
that thing
the
called?
What do you call that?
It's called a reproductivity.
What do you call that thing I experimented with in the 90s?
It's called dating. Yeah.
Nobody is feeling less empathetic about this guy.
But it's basically what it is. If you see some Hederle's wife is very beautiful, and that's why I have no empathy for him. But if Hederle's wife was apparently ugly or plain, I'd be like, "Oh, okay, I feel bad for you, dude," because he's no competition. But if somebody pretty likes him, then he's competition, and which is essentially why nobody cares about any feeling I have, or when something bad happens to me, they actually laugh at me because Liz is pretty.
It's true.
And you have money.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Wealth.
Again.
Wealth. I thought this article was really interesting. The research is interesting. I did want to point out that there was a very low sample size, which
very
was
low.
Discussed. It was only 20 people, and the average age was 21 years old. So that's not really a lot to look from. They also didn't look at the relationship status. So were they single? Were they in a relationship? And what their sexual orientation was. So I thought that was kind of interesting that, you know, there were some significant limitations. Additionally, you know, what is attractive, right? That's a very subjective thing. And fine, we can say someone's, you know, attractive, but to say someone's plain, I don't know. I didn't like how they kind of worded that. And I'd be curious how they were defining attractive.
Hopefully they selected people where there's no question. They're not attractive. And so that's how they create a baseline.
Rude.
All right. Moving on. So there's something called the Monitoring the Future study. It comes out of Michigan University, and it measures drug and alcohol use amongst teenagers, and it's been doing so since 1975. And their latest results for the year 2015, it shows that the lowest percentage of teens are using drugs and alcohol since the 1990s. Now, some researchers believe, however, that social media might be at least partly responsible for this decline, because if that's true, it means that drug and alcohol use hasn't so much declined because kids are spending less time hanging out or making better choices. It's that they're actually alone more, staring at their phones and growing into socially isolated, hunchbacked teetotalers.
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 Woo! Yeah, I think this research is pretty cool, and there are some kind of protective factors that you could consider where, you know, the developing brain may be more resilient, but exposure to alcohol and drugs does kind of disrupt that natural brain maturation process. But, you know, I also think about how drug and alcohol use in the teen years is kind of this important developmental milestone, right? That experimentation, it helps you with problem solving, right? So is this a good choice, a bad choice? You know, I think too about just how teens are curious, they're bored, and you're getting exposure to kind of having these bonding moments with your friends when you are kind of navigating these new experiences. And so we're kind of missing out on that social piece now. And I don't really know what long-term this kind of how this is going to pan out, but I do think it's a really important line of research.
But isn't the research saying that it's kind of a myth that kids aren't having face-to-face relationships with people and spending time outside? It's kind of this sort of a myth that we've constructed because we say, oh, these kids are just playing video games and they're on social media and they're not really interacting with real people. I don't know that holds up in the research.
Yeah, I kind of am in agreement with you on that piece. But I mean, just anecdotally, like when I go out to restaurants now and I see big groups of kids, they are not talking to each other. Fine, they're there in real life, IRL, and they are, you know, texting, they're snapping, they're doing all these different things, but they're not communicating with each other.
Yeah, so, I see that a lot.
Yeah, and so maybe there's a distinction between the amount of social media and technology use versus being specifically physically isolated, because there is research that came out of UCLA this year that found that likes on social media activate the reward centers in teens' brains. That area is also associated with sexual gratification and intoxication. So there is something about their finding, you know, getting those likes and loves and upvotes on social media. It is kind of activating the same part of the brain that we normally would associate with some of those risky behaviors like drugs or early teen sex. So it'll be interesting to see where the research goes from here.
Yep. All right, let's take a break, and when we come back, we'll talk about our trending topic, which is the resurgence of sci-fi and horror films. This is the Shrink Tank Podcast. Hey, this is Dave Verhagen, one of the hosts of Shrink Tank and also author of the new book, Liberia's Son. Liberia's Son tells the true story of UJ Harris, who, as a child, was caught in the crossfire of an unexpected, brutal civil war in West Africa. When I met UJ and learned his story, I knew I had to write this book. I knew I wanted his story to be told. It's a great story of hope, courage, and resilience. It's available at HeroHousePublishing.com and Amazon.com. I hope you'll consider picking it up. Welcome back to the Shrink Tank Podcast. I'm Dave Verhagen in Nashville, along with Frank Gaskell, Emma Kate Wright, and Jonathan Hederle in Charlotte. And our trending topic today is the resurgence of sci-fi and horror films. And if you think about the last year, there's been a ton of horror movies. The Witch, Don't Breathe, Train to Busan, The Purge. sci-fi movies, Arrival, Passengers, Midnight Special, The Fifth Wave. And if you look ahead into 2017, there's more than 24 horror films that are slated for release. It is a lot. And we've always had horror movies. We've always had sci-fi. It just seems like there is an abundance of them. So before we get into talking about why now, let me ask you guys, do you have a particularly favorite recent, not old school, but recent horror or sci-fi movie?
Honestly, I have not seen a lot of movies that are in the horror genre, but I did really enjoy Midnight Special. I just kind of stumbled upon that on Netflix. I hadn't heard about it, and I was just like, what is this? This is awesome. It was really fun. It made me think. It wasn't super clear, and it kind of left it up to the audience to decide what was going on.
And just a little sidebar on that one. The director, Jeff Nichols, is a graduate of the UNC School of the Arts. So he's... graduate of school right down the road. Frank, how about you?
Well, a couple things. Dave and you and Hederly recommended that I should see Midnight Special, and I believe you said it was as close as it comes to Close Encounters of the Third Kind for this generation, and it totally was. I mean, that movie blew my mind. I loved it. I've probably seen it 5 or 6 times. My kids, I think it's Maddox's favorite movie other than Star Wars. I liked Interstellar. I wasn't crazy about it, but in terms of horror, it's got to be. I'd say it's Train to Busan or The Autopsy of Jane Doe. Both of those are kind of up there for me.
You know, when I think of sci-fi, The Martian, I really enjoyed in recent years. That was more kind of just populist fun. I go back about 15 years, a little movie called Children of Men, which I thought was just an amazing movie with so much subtext and commentary on our culture and terrorism and things like that. To me, that movie just blew me away when I saw that. In terms of horror films, I'm not really a horror person, I'll be quite honest, which is why this year has kind of stood out, because I have found myself watching a lot of horror films or movies that are right on that line between horror, suspense, and thriller, mm-hmm. because they've been getting some phenomenal reviews. And so this year alone, Autopsy of Jane Doe, I saw, Don't Breathe, I saw, 10 Cloverfield Lane, I saw. And then probably for me this year, the one that was just so tense and frightening to me was The Green Room. It was...
I forgot about that.
The Green
that
Room was
so
just,
intense.
Wow. Yeah.
That's my number one. No question about that. And
I haven't
realize
seen it.
House. Oh, you got to watch
with,
it.
It's with Anton Yelchin and Patrick Stewart.
Patrick Stewart is like a legit bad guy. Terrifying.
That's pretty awesome. Yeah, I'm going to go back to something you already said. This is what I was going to say is Children of Men is in recent years probably... my favorite. I saw it with a group of guys, probably 5 or 6 guys, and I was surprised because I walked out of the movie and we do our little ritual of like, what'd you think? I was the only person that loved the movie. Everybody else in that group were like, I don't know, I'm not sure. And I think that's a movie that holds up over time really, really well. It's one of the few movies I've seen more than once. There are a couple sequences I've watched 3 or 4 times.
I never knew you ever saw a movie more than once.
A few times, but yeah, I've seen that movie at least twice, probably 3 times, and I've seen some of the continuous shot segments. Yeah. The segment when they're in the car, and the one where it's the kind of the battle scene where there's the tank and all that stuff in the building. I've seen that probably 3 or 4 times as well. But great stuff. So here's the question. First, I guess we need to get past an assumption. Do you think there is this resurgence of sci-fi and horror, or do you think it's just we've always had that and this is nothing different or new? Do you think we're having more of these films hitting theaters and direct viewing?
I was looking online and trying to kind of count up, is it changing, is it not? And it was hard for me to judge. The sci-fi seemed easier to judge. And I question whether that is sort of a kickoff from J.J. Abrams redoing Star Trek, that you've got these movies that prove you can make a really good sci-fi film, And that's where the dollars are going, and people are piggybacking off Star Wars films. Maybe Guardians helped with that too, but I feel like we are getting more of it, and I don't know if it's a dollar effect or we just need some more content other than superheroes.
Well, I do think that there's more for both, and I think it's primarily economic on both sides, even though what they use with that genre can really speak to our current times. But, you know, now with the advancement of CGI and technology, that they can make it come to light, you know, like Midnight Special is a great example of a movie that uses the effects so lifelike mm-hmm. to enrich a story. And a lot of those types of movies then can make a lot of money. They can be tentpole films, but horror has always been a reliable niche genre that can make a decent amount of money from a relatively modest budget because they have an automatic built-in audience. People love to be scared. People love gratuitous violence. And so they know they're not going to compete with, you know, Marvel films in terms of the revenue, but they know they can spend $20 million on a small film, turn it around fairly quickly, make $60, $80 million. That's a great profit margin, four times the budget.
And I'll tell you the other thing. I believe that if Friday the 13th, Halloween, those like Freddy Krueger, if those films had been made now, they'd all be PG-13, all of them, because that's what these kids are going to go see. And you can slip a lot more of that stuff in, and you've got your ready-made teen market that's going to go out there and get the crap scared out of them.
So in a sense, what you guys are saying, it's kind of like what happened with television when reality shows really took off. It's like they're cheap and people, you know, eat it up. And so they eat it up and it doesn't cost you a ton to produce. So it's going to be driven by the economics of it. One thing, just a little note, I don't want to get too far away from the heart of the conversation, but you mentioned Midnight Special. I'm wondering if you guys felt like this. I gave that movie an A-, not an A. And the minus for me was actually where all the money and the budget went, was toward the ending. I think the ending, with all the kind of the grander special effects stuff, was probably I kind of wish they'd kept a little bit to the imagination on some of that stuff. How did you guys feel about that?
I mean, I'm a sucker for that stuff. I mean, just the idea of seeing all of this massive future parallel universe stuff that is all around us, it magnified the movie for me.
So it actually, you felt like that was a plus for the movie.
It was like Close Encounters for me, that not only do I get to see these little spaceships and there's little, hey, I wonder what that is, what that is, and then the massive mothership comes down and you see it all and you interact with it. That's what really struck the Close Encounters chord for me.
I didn't love it or hate it. It was just sort of an artistic choice that they made. But I can certainly understand what you're talking about, Dave. I mean, they spent so much time in realism and connection, and then it feels very shiny and sort of emotionally removed from the rest of the aesthetics of the film.
Yeah, that's how I felt about it. So back to the heart of this, one of the things we're saying is that there are economic factors driving it, but I wonder if there's also factors that drive it that are more social or cultural or psychological. And what I mean is, do you think that we tend to like to go see horror films or sci-fi movies, either or, during different times of culture, like when culture is at different points and things are happening culturally? And if so, what do you think that's about?
Well, I think sometimes we can. I think oftentimes critics and kind of culture commentators will pick up on that sometimes before the general population. But I think when you think about Iraq, or you think of 9/11 and the early 2000s, and they were making all these movies about the Iraqi war and terrorism, nobody wanted to see that. It was too up close. It was too real. And so a lot of times audiences need some other genre or platform to process a lot of those same themes and fears, but through a different mechanism, so it feels a little bit emotionally removed from real life, so it can still be entertainment and not watching the news. So when you think about, like, even the original Night of the Living Dead, and it's, you know, Vietnam and just, you know, race wars and things along those lines, but filtered through this black and white aesthetic of, you know, an outbreak that's indiscriminate. And in that way, you put aside these, you know, these racial divides and issues about the war in Vietnam halfway across the country, and you have to band together. And that's something that's really powerful for people.
Well, and that's what George Romero did with Night of the Walking Dead.
Yeah.
It was a movie about racism and alienation, all that kind of stuff.
So, Frank, do you think there are things going on culturally that are driving some of the renewed interest in these movies?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with everything Hederle said. My dork nature says I'm hoping we get a bunch of these sci-fi movies because we as a people are really thinking about, we're filling the earth up. What are we going to do? Where are we going to go? What's that going to look like? And plus we have these icons of aeronautics, space engineering, building private vehicles to space. So it seems like that stuff is more on our minds. And again, I would echo what Hederle said about horror films. It's another way to deal with what we're going through without having to deal with it directly.
What's interesting about sci-fi as a broad genre is that it cuts both ways. In one sense, some sci-fi is very optimistic and some sci-fi is very pessimistic. It'd be interesting to see in the coming year and 2 years from now if our sci-fi films reflect more of a pessimism or an optimism or something like that.
You know, in looking back at sci-fi in the 70s, so we have this whole space race. So what do we get? We get Star Trek, then we get The Black Hole, we get Star Wars, we get these films about space a decade or so after that kind of launch. And I'm wondering if we're having some of the same effect now. It's just ramped up because we can produce movies faster.
Well, and I think also, like, two of the sci-fi pieces this past year, Arrival and Westworld, and Westworld obviously is a television series, although it was originally a movie
in the
based on the 70s. Both of them really revisit universal themes that sci-fi, you know, taps into. So Arrival, it really is the age-old, the world has to band together, because if we really focus on opposition towards one another, we're going to be our own destruction, versus can we come together for a collective goal? And then when you think of Westworld, it talks about the just, you know, violence and what are the lengths to be entertained? Like, where will we go that, because we are such a desensitized culture, that this is the way that we can find pleasure and entertainment as well as advancements in technology before it starts to work against us?
But it's also these movies that are exploring what does it mean to be human? You know, where do we? It's all this like future tech. We're getting closer and closer and closer, and we're either aware of it consciously or unconsciously that we're moving toward that singularity, or the technology is so much a part of our lives. Where do we end and technology begin? And that blurred line. I think we're seeing a lot of movies that explore that as well.
I definitely think that, and we feel that on a daily basis with Siri and Alexa and other, you know, in our car. It's like it feels like we're in the presence of another person, but there's not another person there. It's a form of technology, and so that's got to seep into our collective consciousness or unconsciousness around our thinking about, like, where do we end and technology begin, and what does it mean to be a person and a human and all that stuff. So I think there's definitely a technological piece of it as well.
So, like, if you had C-3PO, he was there with you all the time, would you consider him technology or a person?
Probably a person.
Yeah, but that's weird, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I want that. I want that real bad. I want a C-3PO.
Well, like, we have Alexa. You have Alexa in your house. I don't think of Alexa as a person, but if it was in a human form, the same thing, I think I would. Yeah. I think I would emotionally feel like it was a person in my house.
Well, I was talking to somebody today who commented, they changed Alexa's name to his wife's name. And so then he'll call his wife's name and give it a command and it'll happen. And he was like, that's freaky. I realized that was freaky when it started happening.
I tell you, be careful with Alexa, boys and girls, because you may have a colleague who goes into your office and asks Alexa to order certain products, shall we say? And then you go on Amazon to actually buy something and your cart is filled with various products.
Oh, products, yeah.
as we call them.
Yes. All right. Well, with that, we're going to take one last break and we'll be right back with our doctor's orders. This is the Shrink Tank Podcast. Hi, this is Dave Verhagen. We're glad you listened to the Shrink Tank Podcast. And if you have room for one more podcast in your life, please check out Blew My Mind. Dr. Craig Pohlman and his panel talk about things in pop culture that blew their minds. It might be a love song, a movie twist, a television finale. It's something that blew their minds. You can hear it on shrinktank.com or download it through iTunes. It's Blew My Mind. Check it out. We're back again with Dave Verhagen, Frank Gaskell, Emma Kate Wright, and Jonathan Hederle, and we wrap this all up with our doctor's orders. These are things that we're personally enjoying in pop culture, and Frank, do you have something for us?
I do, and it's a very odd thing to recommend. I want you to go out and get one of these aluminum, it's made a lot of different things. It's a holder for your iPhone and a charger for your Apple Watch. And every day, so I didn't use my Apple Watch because it was always not losing its charge. I didn't really care about it, but I bought just this simple $9 little thing, and every time I come home, I stick my iPhone and my watch on it. It charges, it's right there, and it's made it a consistent thing in my life. But without that, I never used it.
All right. Jonathan.
Whew, thank you for that.
Yeah, whatever. Both of you.
I mentioned last episode I've been going on a movie binge the last few weeks, and I wanted to talk about a few movies I saw that aren't going to get a lot of press come award season time, but I found them to be genuinely enjoyable films. We actually talked about one of them here today, The Autopsy of Jane Doe. You can find it on Amazon Video or iTunes. It's a really tense kind of suspense horror film. Just be prepared. The title does give a little bit away of what will be unsettling. Another movie is called The Meddler with Susan Sarandon and Rose Byrne. My wife and I watched it together. It's a mother-daughter relationship film, and it's
that
really
sounds awful.
It actually was very, very sweet. And if you've experienced any type of loss of parent and then dealing with your widowed parent, that movie might be particularly meaningful or sensitive. And then the other movie I finally caught was Hail Caesar, the Coen brothers film that stars, I think I'm going to butcher his last name, but Alden Ehrenreich, something like that, who's going to play the new Han Solo.
Oh, yeah.
He is a really good actor. And after watching Hail Caesar, I feel really good about the choice that they made to have him play Han Solo.
Do you know who just signed on for episode?
Woody Harrelson.
Woody Harrelson. How about that? Yeah.
Well, I will tell you that I agree with you after watching Hail Caesar that he's a really good actor, but I didn't like the
movie. I found the movie to be one of those classic Coen messes of comedy that's really not well structured, and they do that with a lot of their comedies, whereas a lot of their suspense or more adult ones, they're much tighter as a proper film.
Yeah, I didn't think it was very good. I thought he was very good, but I didn't think the movie was very good. My recommendation is a book. It's called The Daily Show, The Book, an oral history.
The Daily Show, The Book.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
So I am, as many of you know, a big student and fan of American comedy. And so I've read all the backstage histories of Saturday Night Live, of The Second City, of different stand-up comics, Steve Martin, and so on. And this is right up there with it. They've interviewed everybody. You name it. Steve Carell, Colbert, of course, Jon Stewart. And they just talk about from the time Jon Stewart took over to the time he left, the significant moments in the history of The Daily Show. It's really good stuff.
Is it worth
reading.
Is it an audio book?
You can get it as an audio book as well.
Does Jon Stewart read it?
I do not know.
Okay, I'll get that.
I bought the hard hardcover book. So, but I do know there's an audiobook out there.
Okay, cool.
All right. So that's going to do it for this edition of the Shrink Tank Podcast. We hope you'll check out shrinktank.com for articles and videos and polls about all kinds of things in popular culture. Make sure you check out shrinktank.com. And also, we want you to follow us on Twitter at Shrink Tank Talk and like us on Facebook by searching for the Shrink Tank Podcast. And if you do that, you can sometimes watch us record this live Wednesdays at 1:15 p.m. Eastern. We are not necessarily going to do that every week, but for the next few months, we'll give it a try, see how it goes. And you'll see all the bloopers and behind-the-scenes stuff in real time, and we hope you'll join us for that. Our producer is Sean Beck, who also composed this lovely new theme music. In the Queen City, it's Jonathan Hederle, Emma Kate Wright, and Frank Gaskell. And from Music City, I'm Dave Verhagen. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends, and make it a good week.
Shrink Tank.